We're in John chapter 2, verses 1 through 12. For many who have read their Bibles and have heard stories in Sunday school, this will be a familiar story. All those people who want me to make maybe anecdotal observations about how now we can all be consuming alcohol, you're not going to find that from me in this. And so don't look in a direction in that regard. I'm not here to disrupt anyone who feels that they should not consume alcohol, and that's not what the point of this message is in any regard. We may be familiar with the story and the facts of it, so what I want to do today is take you through John chapter 2, 1 to 12, and look at the story. I want to make some observations, and then what I want to do is draw our attention to what I think is some greater meaning that is found within the story. So, the facts, as we have before us. Jesus, it's 3 days, maybe not into his ministry, but as part of his ministry, and he goes to Cana, which we learned in the previous passage, he was on his way there, and he attends a wedding, and he's there with his mother, Mary, and he's brought along his 5 disciples, who, at least the ones that we know about at the moment, and they attend this wedding. At this wedding, they run out of wine. And Mary points out this out to Jesus, who then questions. Jesus himself questions, well, what should I really do about it? But then, through the circumstances, he ends up taking charge, orders the servants to fill 6 of these stone jars full of water that contain 20 to 30 gallons, turns the water into wine, has the servants send it to the master of the feast, who marvels at the quality of the wine, and then he points this out, the master of the feast points this out to the bridegroom, and he also regards this as good wine, and then the master of the feast makes these comments about how the normal wine is brought out, the best wine is usually brought out in the beginning, and the lesser wine brought out near the end of the time with the guests and all of that. So that's kind of the facts of the story. That's what's happened here. But I want to bring us to some observations that we can take out of this text that will help us as we look into the greater meaning of what this story is all about. This story, first of all, is not about one, you know, does the church have a particular role in sanctioning marriages and so forth? That's not the main point. And as I said, this is not a good passage to use in your armament of whether you should drink or not, things like that. That's not the concern. But what we see here is a number of things which we'll get to. But first, some observations. We see that this story, of course, picks up from chapter 1, verses 50 to 51. And in 50 to 51, if you recall, or if you've looked at that before, is at the end there, Nathanael is having his encounter with Jesus. And that encounter comes about because Jesus has revealed to Nathanael that he knows who he is, even though he's never met him. If you recall, it's the story about where he sees him under the fig tree, and Nathanael marvels at this. And it brings them to the point of declaring, you're the Son of God, you are the King of Israel. And Jesus says, you've seen nothing yet. I'm going to show you much greater things. And this story is a part of those greater things, the beginning of them. Second thing I would point out is that in the beginning of this passage, chapter 2, verse 1, it says, on the third day. And when you think the third day, what do you think about? If you've been a Christian for a while, you're thinking about his resurrection. Now, some have tried to bring that connection into this text. I think that's going a little too far. I think all he's really saying is that this is the first part of the first week of Jesus' ministry. And he's saying in the third day, in that time, they went to a wedding. That's probably all it indicates. Another thing that I would observe is that we find here that Mary is there with Jesus and they attend this wedding in Cana. They were invited guests, which means that they were probably close friends or they were relatives of this family. And they must have been close because the wedding hosts They must have been close to those who were part of the wedding because Mary all of a sudden takes initiative. And she knows about the problem of not having enough wine, and she takes responsibility to solve the problem, something that a mere guest would not have done. The bridegroom was normally in charge of providing for his guests, and running out of wine would have been an embarrassment. I was reading something this week where actually the guests of a wedding could bring almost like litigation against the bridegroom if he didn't provide adequately at the wedding feast. So this is a major, major thing. Then I would point out one other thing that's in the first part of this story, where it says in verse 4, "And Jesus said to her, 'Woman.'" Now, how many people would find that a little offensive, right? I did a little study into the use of that phrase, or the use of that word in different contexts this week, and found that our Western ears hear that very differently than they would have heard that. They don't see that or did not take that as a demeaning or pejorative statement. So we have to draw ourselves out of our Western hearing and into how they would have regarded it. He is not being disrespectful to his mother. Then I would also observe this. Jesus says in that same verse, "My hour has not yet come." And this is a reference to his crucifixion. In John chapter 13, verse 1, it references Christ's death and indicates that Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart from this world. Jesus being asked then to provide wine, and his response to that, the way he did, "My hour has not yet come," indicates one of the symbolic meanings of wine that we're going to uncover and unpack a little bit more. Here we find in this is a symbol of Christ's suffering and his death. And it's connected to Matthew 26, 28, when he establishes the Lord's Supper, when he says, "This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins." So I want you, as we are going through this text a little more deeply, to remember that. Then, I also observe that we see here this idea of the six jars. Is there any meaning or significance here? These jars were used for religious purification. Now, we might think that they should be in the temple, but they were used often in different circumstances when there was a group meeting, a banquet, things like that. Also in people's homes when they were having guests over, is that they would have to clean their hands, they would have to clean their feet, and it was used to also clean food, all part of keeping the religious law. You also will notice that it says that they were made out of stone. They were not made out of clay, but carved from stone because clay pots were considered to be impure. And so they wouldn't have used those. It's quite remarkable that they would have carved these. They hold 20 to 30 gallons carved out of a single piece of stone. Quite remarkable. Then, the jars are filled to the brim with water by the servants. And it shows and this shows the amount that was turned into wine. 20 to 30 gallons in each one. Six of them, 120 to 180 gallons of wine, which I think I've mentioned somewhere else that that's approximately 1,000 bottles of wine. And I'm thinking that if there was 200 guests, which would have been a pretty big affair, that's about 5 bottles each. So everyone is doing really well. Everyone's doing really well. Or really badly, depending on how you look at it. Okay? What this also shows, when you see that they fill them to brim, fill them up with water, is that we're seeing that they did not somehow secretly fill these with wine somewhere else and then, oh, there's a miracle, right? It was nothing like that. The servants could testify that they had filled them with water. They knew what was in them. And then we see that Jesus then turns that water into wine. He orders the servants to take it to the master of the feast. This would have been someone that was like a master of ceremonies. And he then could verify that this was wine. In fact, he declares it to be better wine. The servants also verify that the water that they poured in was now wine because they had brought it to him. And when they then take the wine to the bridegroom, who was at one time perhaps embarrassed, now his embarrassment is taken care of, and he also could verify that they were drinking wine. even though the servants knew that it had at one time been water. So just some things that we observe in the text, and I think will help us to understand what's going on here. So verse 11, if I draw you down to there, it tells us how this happened and why. It says, this is the first of his signs. John likes to use the word signs rather than miracles. And so he's signifying something that is happening, and that signification, that sign that he did in this place was a manifestation of his glory, a display, a revealing of his glory. And the result of that was that the disciples believed in him. So what happens? What happens when Jesus shows his glory? Well, we find that tap water suddenly becomes Chateau Lafite 1869, which apparently is supposed to be a very, very good bottle of wine. It becomes exceptional. You find that a humble lunch that a boy brings to a gathering becomes a feast for thousands. And we find that a means of torturous death becomes forgiveness and of sin, and it becomes new life. That's what happens when Christ manifests his glory. And it resulted in the increased belief of these disciples in Jesus. And this is the reason for the signs. In our day and age, sometimes we think about wanting miracles because we simply want to have the miracle. But if you search the scriptures, you find that in the Gospels and the book of Acts, all of them were done to direct people towards a relationship with Christ and the gospel. They weren't just done because they were trying to display power for any old reason. There was always a very specific purpose in it, and that's what Jesus is doing here. It was to create faith. Now, what's going on here is an absolutely amazing act upon Jesus' part. But there's more happening here than water becoming wine. I want us to look at this event through different eyes. We have to see that there is something greater going on here, that what we see is Jesus going to a wedding feast, and where I want your mind to go with this is the marriage feast of the Lamb. The day in which Jesus will host his church, in which he is the bridegroom and the church is the bride, will feast at this banquet when their salvation and their glorification is complete. I also want you to look at this event seeing that what Jesus is doing here is he's taking what is the old order of things and he is bringing in something new. So I want you to keep those things in mind as we look at what's going on. We are told that what happens here manifests his glory. It strengthens the beliefs of the disciples in Jesus. And what we want is that to do the same thing for us. As we see the greater glory of what is going on here, it is to help us to build our faith, to grow more deeply in love with Christ, to trust him all the more. So, let's look at what this signifies. So, when he manifests his glory in that place, he does so as the bridegroom. We've hinted at this already. Now, it was normal for the bridegroom to put on this lavish banquet, and he has the responsibility of making sure that the guests had enough to eat and to drink, and it was, as we said earlier, an embarrassment if he didn't provide all that was needed. So when Jesus is asked to resolve the wine shortage, he takes on the role as the bridegroom. Remember, he's come as a guest. What are guests supposed to be? They're not supposed to be the bridegroom. They're supposed to be there and enjoy the festivities and celebrate with the bridegroom and the bride their marriage. And what we see here as he takes on this role of the bridegroom, we see an echo in the past to Isaiah 25, verse 6, which says, on this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wine, of rich food full of marrow, of aged wine well refined. He is the Lord of hosts, and he's demonstrating that here in this miracle. It also draws the connection of Jesus as the Messiah with the Lord's Supper and the wedding feast of Christ in heaven all together. In Luke 22:15-16, it says, "And he said to them, I have earnestly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer, for I tell you, I will not eat of it until it is fulfilled in the kingdom of God." So you need to draw a connection between the wedding feast, the symbolism of the wine, which we're going to get into more, and also the Passover, and how these things are all brought together. Now, what does this mean for our beliefs? It means that Jesus is the bridegroom, and the church, those who are Christians, are the bride of Christ. And our ability to be Christ's bride, to have our beliefs established, to believe in Jesus Christ, is tied to His sacrifice for us. Ephesians 5:25-26 says that Jesus gave up His life for the church. And like a married couple that becomes one flesh, as Jesus gives up His life, He commits Himself to His bride, the church. And as we believe in Jesus Christ, we commit ourselves to Him and we become one. 1 Corinthians 6:16-17. And there is a union that is established between us and Christ that brings us our righteousness, that makes us pure, that brings us into holiness. 2 Corinthians 5:21. It gives us power, it gives us faith, it gives us His love, Ephesians 3:14-19, and His grace, Ephesians 1:3-14. So when He is the bridegroom and we are the bride, we receive from Him union with Him. We receive righteousness from Him. We receive power and faith and love. And we receive His grace. All of these things to build and establish our faith. Jesus is, in a sense, our husband. The second thing that is signified here as He manifests His glory is Him as a servant. Jesus, again, He's a guest. He's a guest at this wedding. And what does that mean when you are the guest? You're not getting up and making wine. You're not going out and trying to find it. You're being served it. And as the story is presented, Jesus arrives, and immediately He's pressed into serving the needs of others. Now, making water into wine, on the surface, maybe seems almost superficial. Why do they need more wine? Why do they need to make more wine? But what underlies this is Christ's willingness to take on a position that He should not have to. Remember that. Jesus is having to take on a role that He should not have to take. Luke 22:27 says this, "For who is the greater, one who reclines at table or one who serves? Is it not the one who reclines at table? But I am among you as the one who serves." What should Jesus have been able to do? Recline at table. But here He is called into service. In Philippians 2:6-7, we read this, "Who though He was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied Himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men." He didn't have to grasp being God because He is God, and He comes down to earth, and what does He do? He becomes a servant. Not something He should have had to do. And He did not enter into this service reluctantly. He did it in order to relieve our suffering in this life and in the life to come. Mark 10:45 says, "For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give His life as a ransom for many," to relieve their suffering. So Jesus gave up His position as a guest. He takes on the role of a servant. He got out of it, if we put it in our modern day way of thinking, He got out of His suit and His tie, and He put on the uniform of a servant, and He provided those guests with what they needed. Jesus got up from the table at Passover, and He put a towel around His waist, and He washed His disciples' feet. His disciples should have bowed at His feet, and yet He got down and He washed theirs. So what might this mean for our belief? It means that Jesus' service to us on the cross led to our faith in Him. Now, when you want to buy a product, companies may try to get you as a consumer to believe in their products. They have product demonstrations. One of the biggest disappointments of Costco right now is that they have these displays out there with product, but you can't have any. It's like a tease. It's not even fair. I don't know what the point is. So they put on these demonstrations, or they're supposed to give up free samples. Can't get free samples right now. It's very disappointing. Or you go to a car dealership wanting to buy a car, and you get to test drive the car, right? All of these ways are to get you to buy into their product. What did Jesus do? What did Jesus do to sell us on the fact that He was the Messiah? That He was Christ? That He was the Son of God? That He is the King of Israel? He stepped down from His throne and He became the servant of those who should have served Him. He provided their needs. He healed the sick. He gave food to those who were hungry. He taught them the truth. And ultimately, He gave His life on the cross. He demonstrated true love and true grace because He tasted death for us so that we would not have to. And so we should believe in Him. The third way that we see Jesus signifying His glory is by being the provision. Now we talked about this already, we've hinted at it, where He says, "My hour has not yet come." And that's referring, as we said, towards His hour, the hour being that time in which He is to go to the cross, die upon it, and 3 days later rise again. John uses this almost exact phrase three times, chapter 7, verse 30, chapter 8, verse 20, and 13, verse 1. And they all refer to what we see in chapter 17, 1, where Jesus says, "Father, the hour has come. Glorify Your Son, that the Son may glorify You." So He's referring to that hour when He will be nailed to the cross, He will shed His blood, and He will die. Now, let's keep that in mind. That's what He's thinking about. From there, we have to understand how this connects to the wine. Wine is a symbol of God's wrath. He pours out the cup of His wrath as a reference to Him pouring out His judgment on people in Psalm 75, verse 8. But also it's used in Jeremiah 23, 9 to refer to quenching spiritual thirst. So it goes from judgment to relief. And then, of course, in Matthew 26, 27 to 28, we read about Jesus giving Himself His blood as the means of forgiveness when He's taking that communion with His disciples. "This is My blood of the covenant, which is poured out for you for the forgiveness of your sins." So when Jesus is asked to solve the wine problem, this is very interesting, at least I think so. When He's asked to solve the wine problem, and He answers as He does, He's saying this: "The wine that I have to give is My blood that takes away sin." He's so focused on His mission. Him and his mom are having one of the first recorded instances of communication breaks. They're not on the same page. They're not looking in the same direction. Mary is there saying, "We're out of wine. Solve the problem." And I don't know what she expected. Did she expect him to go out to the liquor store and buy some? Did she expect that he knows someone that has it? Did she expect him to do a miracle? We might like to think that's what she expected. He's being asked to make wine that comes from grapes, and Jesus is thinking about the wine of His death. And then it seems like He almost kind of snaps out of that, out of His focus on the cross, and then He uses this opportunity to provide for the wedding. Now, to those in attendance, the servants, Mary and the disciples, This was certainly an extraordinary event. But to John's readers, to those that are reading it after, and to each one of us here, we have the opportunity to see this in the greater picture of the cross and of his sacrifice upon it. If we read the events through the eyes fixed on the cross, we see something greater. We see Jesus pouring out mercy on people. They had drank all the wine. He's pouring out his mercy on people that have already had enough. They are filled to the brim. They have filled themselves, if we want to put it in a symbolic way, they have filled themselves with the wine of this world. They had drunk plenty. They were completely undeserving of his provision, but he gives it to them anyway. They had filled themselves up with things that are here and now, and yet he still provides them with what they really need. We see that Jesus provides what is better. This world has its wine, it has its forgiveness, its forms of salvation, it has its redemption. But Jesus, as you notice in our text, provides what is noticeably better. The best that this world has to offer is poison in compared to what Jesus provides in his wine, which is medicine for the soul. We see Jesus giving lavishly and abundantly. This world supplies that which runs out, that which is insufficient to meet our need. Sin is great. It is devastating to the soul, but the wine of Christ's sacrifice is enough for every life for which he has died. It is more than enough. So this has meaning for our belief in him. And it tells us that Jesus is our only provision. We have all at one time, every one of us, drunk deeply of the world's wine. We not only tasted it, we were drunk on excess, we were intoxicated on sin, and yet while we were yet sinners, Jesus poured himself out for us. We have seen that this world's wine is swill compared to what Christ offers, and yet how often are we still, at moments, drinking of it? Christ has offered us the finest vintage, and we keep reaching for the wine that comes in a box. Our world offers us wine that leaves us thirsty. It's not much better than drinking salt water. The abundance of Christ's provision invites us to drink deeply from him because his wine never runs out. So Christ's provision is mercy when we did not deserve it. It was infinitely greater than this world, and it abundantly satisfies us. We should believe in Jesus, for he is our portion, and he is greater. Then we see, as he manifests his glory, we see him turning law into grace. Let's draw our attention to these six jars. These six jars that are used for the Jewish purification rites. And what these six jars signify is the Jewish law. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 24 and 25 indicate that through keeping of the law comes righteousness, comes justification. Being right, we can almost take in a way as being close to that which is being clean, to being purified. That a person, through the keeping of a law, would be clean before the Lord. But this cleansing was always temporary. One would again, over and over again, be defiled by sin. People could bathe all they wanted from the law, but they could never have enough. It was never a cleansing. Romans 3, verse 20 says to us that by the works of the law, no human being will be justified in his sight. No one will be clean by the law. So the law serves a purpose of pointing to our need for Christ, not as an adequate alternative to Christ. When Jesus fills the jars with water, he takes the old order. He takes that which is represented in the law, and he transforms it. He changes it from something unable to something that is beautiful. He takes something that cannot fulfill for us, and he makes it fulfilling by his transformation of it. It has now become His wine. The wine that Jesus provides, the wine of His blood, and this wine can do what the law could never do. Under the law, blood was used for purification from sin, Hebrews 9:22, but it was never adequate, Hebrews 10:11. When Jesus shed His blood, we were justified and saved from God's wrath, Romans 5, verse 9. And what Jesus did was He took what was law, He turns it into grace. The blood of sheep and goats was law, and the blood of Christ is His grace. And this is indicated earlier in John chapter 1, verse 17, where it says, the law was given through Moses, but grace and truth come through Jesus Christ. And it's reinforced in Ephesians 1, verse 7, where it says, in Him we have redemption through His blood, the forgiveness of our trespasses according to the riches of His grace. So this is what this miracle says. You should no longer seek cleansing from vessels of the law. For now I provide you with blood that truly and finally cleanses you from all of your unrighteousness. What does this mean for us? It means that through Jesus we receive the wine that cleanses us from our sins as well. I'm reminded of Shakespeare's Macbeth, when Lady Macbeth is haunted by the horrors that she has carried out, and she is sleepwalking, and she exclaims this, and I'm reading the text, so she says, out, damned spot, out, I say. But she cannot find relief, and later she says, here's the smell of the blood still, all the perfumes of Arabia will not sweeten this little hand. That is the fate of all of us under the law. All the washing in the world will not remove the spot. All the remedies of this world cannot cover the smell of sin. But when Jesus shed His blood, we are sprinkled clean. No more spot. No more stench of sin. And why then would we believe in any other name than Jesus? Jesus is the only one who permanently relieves us of our guilt and shame. And to believe in any other is foolishness. And then we see one more way in which this manifestation of His glory takes shape. It is by Him providing joy. What is a wedding feast if the food runs out and the wine is all gone? The revelry, the celebration is hindered. I imagine the servants going to the master of the feast and whispering in his ear, we're out of wine. It would be kind of similar to, say, someone in who's waitering at a banquet for a wedding and goes to the MC and says, we're out of wine. It has the same meaning then as it has now. It just is, oh no, and if you're not, you know, if it's an event where you're not drinking, then it's, we ran out of food. It's not how it's supposed to work. For some of us who go to a lot of weddings, that's maybe one of the things we look forward to the most, is having a good meal out of the deal. But when Jesus provides the wine, even though the master of the feast was unaware of its source, He marveled at how great it was. I like what Andreas Kossenberger indicates what this could signify. He says this. At the Cana wedding, Jesus is the bringer of messianic joy who fills up the depleted resources of Judaism. It reminds me time and time again of when we read in Leviticus and Numbers. Have you read Leviticus and Numbers in the last while? Read it again. Read it again and think of it in terms of covering for sin. And the priest would go daily to his work over and over and over and over again. every day making sacrifices for sin, because every day sin was being committed and every day sin had to be covered. And it was never ending. And hundreds and thousands and tens of thousands of animals had to shed their blood. And every day he went to his service to provide. The duties were unending. And then enters Jesus. And he fills what is missing. He brings joy where once there was only desperate, endless inadequacy. He has come and he has said, "It is finished." And his blood is the once and for all sacrifice for all sin. Jesus replaced dutiful drudgery with deliverance and delight. And this has meaning for our belief, because Jesus gives his wine of abundant joy. Now, do we find joy in something that fails, in something that runs out? Can you just imagine that wedding, that feast? You have 200 guests. You had enough food for 100. You served everyone. 100 people go without food, just sitting at their tables, eating buns, or if they even had that. It'd be very disappointing. You'd feel embarrassed. How about when a child gets one of these toys that has the sealed battery, you can't actually replace the battery, and they play with it and play with it? How much joy is there in that toy when the battery dies? "Mommy, Daddy, I need another toy. This one's broken." How about when you buy a car or you get a new gadget? You buy a house. What happens? In time, the car breaks down. The new gadget becomes obsolete. And the house needs windows and shingles. It all breaks down. We attain money, the career of our dreams, success. And in time, the money runs out. The career has its hassles. And the success only leads to a desire for more success. When are we never thirsty? When are we never hungry? When are we never discontent? When are we never dissatisfied? When are we never tired? And when are we never weary? It is when we drink deeply from the wine that Christ provides. He says, "Drink in remembrance of him." He says, "Drink and never be thirsty again." He says, "He is the bread of life. Eat of me, and you will never go hungry." He says that he gives life abundantly. He says, "Be satisfied in the fruit of his work." He says, "Come who are weary, and he will give you rest." We increasingly believe in Jesus as we receive the joy that he provides. He is our most fulfilling life. So what does it take to believe in Jesus? Someone comes up to you and says, "I'm the Messiah." You would need some extraordinary means to demonstrate that that was true. And that's what happens here. Jesus demonstrates by extraordinary means. It takes miracles. And the disciples saw what was going on, and their belief in Jesus deepened by the water becoming wine. And every Christian, whoever came to believe in Jesus, came to believe in Jesus because a miracle was worked in them. The Holy Spirit turned blind eyes into eyes that can see, and hard hearts into hearts that beat for Christ. It was a miracle each and every time. So this story is about making belief. It reveals our bridegroom that Jesus Christ is taking care of all of our needs. It humbles us and helps for us to give our hearts to him when we see the King of Glory serving us when we should have served him. It should astonish us at how abundant, how lavish, how merciful is Jesus' provision for what we need to overcome sin. It reminds us of how Jesus did not accomplish his work by the law, but by through grace, grace that we have received. And it brings us joy that is better in any in every way to all other claims of joy. So it makes belief, it also increases belief. If I buy this winter, let's say if I buy myself a snowblower, and I do so and I buy a particular snowblower because of the online reviews, maybe the manufacturer's claims, maybe you've recommended a brand to me and I buy it based on that, so it's your personal endorsement. And maybe I even have gained some confidence in the snowblower because, you know, there was 2 inches of snow and I had to try it out, and so I ran around my driveway blowing dust into the air in order to see how well it worked. All of these things can help. But what happens if we get about 18 inches, maybe a good 24 inches of wet snow? And then I pull out my snowblower and I start it up and I just mow down that snow and I'm blowing it 20 feet in the air and I go, now this is a snowblower. I gain confidence more than I had ever had before. And this story says to us, look at Jesus. Look at what he has done. Look closer at what is going on here. Believe more deeply in Jesus. Trust in Jesus more deeply than ever before, and let it shape everything that you are and everything that you do. He has turned our misery into joy. He has transformed us where we were under the penalty and the of sin and death. He has taken all of our attempts to try to bring ourselves out of it by the use of the law and our different means, and he's replaced it with the wine that tastes good and delivers all. I believe in this Jesus. And I hope you will too, more deeply. Drink deeply from the fount of Christ. Let us pray.